pleased to have Mark Bailey with us. Mark is a retired UCC minister, and so he's a colleague of mine. We've known each other from working on committees together. We've never had a chance really to work together yet. This is our first time. And I'm really, he has been part of an organization for quite a long time called A Different Future. I'm going to let him tell you about what A Different Future is all about in a minute. But they have a website, you can go there and see. He spent some time in Israel, I'm going to say 2, 3, 4 years, or 3.5 years, when he was at the Cancer Institute in Jerusalem, which is a great place to be. And it happens to be a place kind of where east meets west, partly around academic and intellectual pursuits. And I was realizing, just talking to Dave Owen beforehand, who's in Israel every week, and he was just saying, you know, about telling us an update. And I feel kind of out of it, so I asked Martin to come. I was there 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and haven't had a chance to go back. And as you may not know, it's my fond hope that we can get through the Christ Church to Israel. I just haven't been brave enough to do it. But I do hope that in the next couple of years we can get a group to go over there so we can talk about these matters further. And I'll turn it over to Mark.
Thank you, sir. Great to be here. And Chuck, I really appreciated the work you did here today and was grateful for the insights you showed. Let me tell you, to begin with, how I got involved in all of this. Because I think that sort of opens the window to who I am and also to what I have studied. I was the editor of our national UCC magazine for 30 years before becoming the director of communications in the National Council of Churches. In 1969, a colleague and I took a group of church journalists in the Middle East. That was a long time ago. The fighting in between Israel and Egypt and Jordan had just concluded. As a matter of fact, we made a swing around several countries, entered Israel across the Allenby Bridge from Jordan, and the newspapers the next day said that for a 20-minute period, the shelling stopped across the bridge. We had important conversations with King Hussein, and we were going to have one with Golda Meir, and that was, of course, known to the political parties. And so we made our way across the bridge safely without any difficulty. But that really began what, for my wife and me, was a love affair with Jerusalem, particularly, and Israel and Palestine in general. We love the old city of Jerusalem. All its little wandering streets, the walls that go way, way back, people who live there and work there and run the stores, the people who worship there, and also the people who come into the city from various places, both in Israel and in the emerging state of Palestine. So we have gone back over the years. My wife then went back and did a sabbatical. She was pastor at the Union Church in Montclair. She went back and on sabbatical to Tom Tour. Loved it so much that she wanted to go back after he retired. And they invited her to join the staff and to bring me along. And that was pretty great, too. I worked with the Middle East Council of Churches in that period for 3.5 years. The Middle East Council of Churches is a Christian group throughout the Middle East, but especially I worked in the Jerusalem office. And that was great because it gave me an opportunity to work with the leaders of the various churches in that area, Catholic and Orthodox and Lutheran and Anglican and a whole series of Catholic groups, not just the what we would call the Roman Catholic, and they call the Latin Catholic, but a whole group of Christians. And that was an introduction to one of the things that I often think about in terms of Jerusalem particularly, but the Holy Land in general. One of the first leaders said to me, said, "You know, Martin, here in Jerusalem, the centuries live together. Centuries coexist." And he said, "You know, this was where the faith began. This is where Pentecost took place. And our churches remember that. But we also remember what happened yesterday. We know what is happening today." And that is true not only of the Christian community here, but of the Jewish community and the Muslim community as well. In his sermon today, Chuck made a comment that he would hope that the Christians in the Holy Land, the Middle East, could somehow be a catalyst for change and for peace. And one of the things that I want to tell you is that that is already happening. There are Christian groups that are deeply committed to finding a way to have peace in the Middle East in general and in Israel and Palestine. One of the things that I am often asked is the question, is there any hope today? Are things so bad that they just are not going to get any better soon? What will it take to make a difference? And one of the things that I have to say is that the life of the Christian community there, essentially a life of service, wanting not to convert anyone. They've long since realized that that's not their role in that plan. But their life is one of service to others. And it is out of that life of service that they make friends with Jews on the one hand and Muslims on the other, and are helping to bring people together. The other sign of hope that I want to speak about a bit this morning is this organization called A Different Future. When we moved back, after we'd lived there for 3.5 years, and we decided we needed to come back because our grandchildren were growing up without us, and we really seen them a little bit more than we had a chance to, I became involved in an organization that was just beginning, which is called A Different Future. It was started by a professor at Yale University, a Jew, who was convinced from his reading that there is a majority of peoples in Israel and in Palestine who want peace, but who simply don't quite know how to bring it about. And he wanted to find a way, if possible, to gather Christians and Muslims and Jews in the United States together to help that happen in the Holy Land. He thought, and he is right, that the United States must play a significant role if there is to be peace there. In his sermon today, Chuck asked for a call for a modern Gandhi, and we all wish that could happen. He even admitted or suggested in his sermon that is that we're in a different kind of a world today in the world in which God is in. And one of the factors in the world today is there is a single superpower that plays a very dominant role in the Middle East and in the world. And so one of the functions of A Different Future is to try to help the United States, people in the United States, the government of the United States, see that it has a very important role to play in bringing the people together, in not being a judge and coming up with some wise decision of itself, but encouraging the parties to work together. The other thing that Bruce Wexler, Professor Bruce Wexler from Yale, realized was that there are people in Israel and Palestine, Jews and Christians and Muslims, who are already doing important things that we don't hear about. We don't hear about it here, and it's not widely known even there in Israel or Palestine, and certainly not in if the Israelis don't know about it. So one of the tasks of a different future is to help make that known. Bruce had the skill of getting a bundle of money together. He talked to a number of prominent, wealthy individuals who were willing, who thought his goal and his dream was a wise one, and were willing to put some money into it. And so we have deployed advertising firms, public relations firms, in Israel and Palestine, and here in the United States, to try to make those things known. For example, there is a group in Israel and Palestine called the Bereaved Parents. You may not have heard of them. It was started by a man by the name of Yitzhak Franklin. His son was a soldier in the Israeli army and was killed. And rather than being angry and dedicating the rest of his life to getting people who killed his son, he reached out to bereaved parents among the Palestinians and said, "We've got a job to do because of who we are. We can't bring our children back, but we can help avoid it happening to others." And so they built a network that goes across the wall and that goes into communities. There are Muslims and Jews and Christians who are members of this organization, Bereaved Parents, and who are trying to do that. But they're not terribly well known. So a different future through these public relations firms has helped to make that organization better known in both the West Bank and in Israel. And they have brought teams of Bereaved Parents to this country, made trips all across the country, and we organized a public relations program for them. As an old journalist myself, you can imagine why that appealed to me in particular. But it was a way in which that could be known. And there are other groups, numerous groups. There are something like 60 groups over there that are trying to bridge the gaps and to find ways at a human level to develop a peaceful approach. And we are trying to help make that better known. We also recognize, as I indicated, that we have a task in helping our government and the people of the United States to understand that we have a role to play. And one of the problems, frankly, here is that there are those people who are passionately for Israel and the people who are passionately for the Palestinians. And the government has been spread in those areas. A different future brought together the top leaders of the Jewish community, both lay people in the Jewish community and leaders of the major Jewish denominations, so called, along with Christian leaders, the leaders of our major denominations, Catholic, Protestant, and even evangelical leaders, and brought together imams and others from the Muslim community. And they have met together three times now in Washington and developed a platform that they have presented to President Bush and Condoleezza Rice and have begun to be the basis for a new approach in among the United States government. So that's what the Living Future is all about. And I'm pleased to be working with you because I think it is so important that you reach out on an interfaith basis to work for peace in that area. Well, I have said enough. I'll be glad to respond to comments and questions and get to the discussion. Hi.
Yeah, well, do you think that if we can get peace in Israel, we can get peace in the Middle East also as well? Can we get there? That's pretty much the heart of it.
Yeah, I think that it is, and that's one of the things that we're saying in the future, and the leaders of the three faiths are saying to Mr. Bush. Unfortunately, the problems in Israel and Palestine are the heart of it, are the core issues. And if we can somehow defuse that problem, some of the other issues are going to fall away. It's complicated. It's not as simple as just saying. But it is a very key problem. And rather than do what some people think, we ought to save the hard problems to last, I believe that we need to tackle a very tough problem early on. And once that is resolved, then maybe it can be easier to resolve.
The problem is the nationalism between both sides. Both sides of the Palestinians were proud of being who they are, and just Israel. That's pretty much the main problem. That started in the like 1870s. And it's been gone ever since. So, really the problem is, if we can find a place where they both can agree, like, if we could put pieces of Jordan, Syria, Egypt, Israel, if we could actually split certain spots of it in a certain area from Palestine, so when you get there from that, you could just talk to each other.
Good question.
That's a good question. I don't think the only problem with what you said is when you said if we could split it. And one of the problems with that whole part of the world now is that some Americans, and particularly some British people, right after World War I, thought they would split up. And they did a poor job. And we're still living with that. So we need to build relationships, I think, among people there. Not only among Israelis and Palestinians, but with Lebanese and Syrians and Iraqis and Egyptians and the others in the area. You know, one of the things that President Carter was trying to do was try to find a way in his Camp David talks to bring those people together and help them realize that the Middle East could be a very strong regional area economically if they would work together. And there were some people in Israel and Palestine who really caught that vision. We wanted to work that way. It hasn't happened yet, but it's still true. There is a wealth of people, insight, a lot of products there, and it could be an economic area.
Well, I'm just wondering if you were surprised by the Palestinian election that swept Hamas to power, and the degree to which it was, and what you think that actually means, and that maybe just having been there and lived, if you could explain for us the way Palestinians view Hamas, it probably is different than the way it's depicted in the papers.
I was neither surprised at the way that election turned out, nor at the way the recent election in Israel. And I think both of them help us to understand the whole problem if we understand both of those. the original topic that I suggested to Chuck was how holy is Hamas? And that was meant to be sort of a provocative title. But the fact is that what we hear about Hamas is the military threat. There has been for a long time a wing of Hamas, the larger part of it actually, is a social service organization. They run the schools. They run the nurseries. They run some of the hospitals. They run the food distribution. And so the people have become dependent on them. And at a time when Arafat and some of his cronies were not doing things for the people so much as for themselves, I don't know how much money they pocketed, but there's corruption in a lot of places, and there certainly was there. After all, Mr. Arafat has reminded that several times, was an outside, he was a pretty good leader of an outside movement. But when he came to power there, he didn't know quite what people needed, and people didn't care for him particularly. Well, Hamas was doing the things that the people needed. And so I wasn't surprised that the elections turned out as well. Now, I wish that Hamas could see the wisdom right now of saying, we need to recognize Israel, we need to recognize the progress that we've made in the last 30 years, and we need to say we'll never get involved in suicide bombing or terrorism again. They probably can't say that right up front at this point, and they lose some of their bargaining chips. But I hope that they will come to a point where they realize that they need to find ways to work peacefully for people. The other thing that I think we need to be aware of is that unless there is some kind of an accommodation to the way in which the Palestinian legislature and government is now being organized, and unless we can somehow get food and some income to the people in Palestine, things are going to fester and get worse. It cannot go on the way it is, because that unemployment there is already running around 70%. And there's not a whole lot of money coming in.
I'm just curious, it's just that some of these two comments that you said about Keith Carter, excuse me, saying in a definition about being economically viable in the region, yet not being able to survive and not provide the service to their country. How are we funding this legitimately after an understanding of standards?
A lot of money is coming from other Arab countries, and it's the one way in which some of the other Arab countries are putting money in the region. They're doing it in some other ways too, but that's one of the ways. It is problematic. But as long as people are hungry and needy,
To put up a point earlier about working through the U.S. government and our actions over there, I think that the actions of the U.S. government in French support of the defense support of Israel is creating a lot of mistrust and animosity in the other countries around there. And we have to say that we're there to help the Palestinians and the other people achieve peace. If, Israel is
our largest benefactor of defense. Well, that's true. We give more money to Israel than almost the rest of the world.
Right.
I mean, it's incredible. You know, yeah. And it's, a lot of it is for defense. That is true. It's also true that Jordan, Egypt, other countries in the region, recognize that the United States is in a very unique place in the world. For one thing, they have, at least until we got too involved in the Iraq War, got so involved in the Iraq War, they look at America as a place of freedom. There are, as a matter of fact, more Palestinians living in the United States today than there are in Palestine. More Christian Palestinians living in the United States today than there are in Palestine. There are also large numbers living in South America. They come here because they want their kids to get education. They appreciate what this country does to offer. So, and that's true not only in terms of Palestine. It's true in Lebanon. It's true even in Syria. So that people recognize that the United States has a very strong, positive things to offer.
Yeah, but I wouldn't agree that that's the majority opinion over there.
It's certainly not the majority opinion of the militants over there. But if you get below the surface, and they're very clear that they make the difference between the country and the people in the United States and the government. We could go any place we wanted and we'll love it. But they say, you know, we don't agree with the government. So they make that distinction in ways that I think sometimes we don't like this country, between the people of
what's behind the mistrust and hatred of the government? It's the amount of money that is given to Israel.
Well,
then, before their terrorist
activity. And has historically been that.
You mentioned that probably won't be the case in the Middle East. The leader states the more aggressive leadership role. So my question to you is, I can't think of one senator or one member of the House who will ever dare say anything dislike the anti-Israel or pro-Palestinian. And just over a week ago, March 22nd and then March 25th, at the Wall Street Journal and the Court of Appeals, there were two articles lambasting a paper written by two professors, one from the University of Chicago and one from Harvard. And the name of the paper was The Israel Lobby. So I got down here because I punched up The Israel Lobby on Google, and sure enough, I went the other way down, one of the main professors, John Mersheimer and Stephen Walsh. And it was 24 pages of the compensation of this paper. And I was really shocked. In fact, I'm shocked in the sense of the power that the Israeli lobby has, not only over our government, but now over our think tanks. I mean, whether the Brookings Institute on the left, or the American Economic Institute on the right, and they're entrenched there too. And my question is, where does this end? What is the end result of this? When American people finally wake up and say, you know, we've had blinders put on our eyes all these years.
Well,
it is strange.
What you're saying is what a lot of people do think, and there's a lot of truth in your assessment. One of the things that gives me hope, especially around the different countries, is that we have been able to bring together the leaders of the three states. And I think that is the only way in which we will be able to get over the blinders that we have here. As a matter of fact, if you go on the internet and read newspapers in Israel, you get a much broader view of what's happening there than you would in the newspapers here. Much better discussion about various options in the Israeli press than we have in our press here about what's happening there. The pressure of certain, how can I say it, carefully, because I think it has to be moved. There are those supporters of the state of Israel in this country who are Israel first, last in office, who are not eager for us to look at the variety of opinions, even that exist in Israel. And I am hopeful that in the future, bringing together Jews, moderate Jews, Christians, and Muslims, moderate Muslims, moderate Christians, will have a balancing force. Actually, the Israeli lobby has been discredited significantly in the last couple of years, releasing some spies that were working for Impact, and our government had just kicked them off. And that has dealt some of the senators and some of the congressional leaders. We've had conversations with the congressional leaders, including New Jersey people. They are much more open in the conversation than in the United. One of the facts is that I haven't realized before that our congressmen in this particular area have not only a fairly large Jewish constituency, but there are fairly large Muslim constituencies also, and Arab constituencies in places like Paris and other places in the region. So that we have an opportunity among our own legislators here to make some points that we question.
Well, you know, when they made the presentation to the open question, it was a rice, what was their reaction? Like, enjoyed that kind of question?
The conversation was primarily the company of Iraq. And several members of the State Department staff. And it was very
important. I just wanted to ask you a question. Well, it's really going to end when people can stop arguing amongst each other in this country, because right now we're having some serious problems with the dead and other things, disasters, new orations and stuff. I just happened to be there, like a year or two before that Katrina actually lived. It was a beautiful country, it was a beautiful city, sorry, country. But the thing is, it got hit, but I don't understand how you could just blame one person over something that's called a natural disaster. Or like, forest fires in California. But you can't blame just the government for that, because what's the government got to control when something's there that's a burn is private property? Anyone can like light a fire on their backyard when it's there. As long as it doesn't get thrown to someone else's yard. So it's right now between first we have to settle the problems in our country, and then we can settle it up, especially Israel and the area that was hit by the tsunami. I think that would be able to take care of that first.
Well, one of the things that I have learned over the years is that we don't have the leadership or the luxury of tackling one problem at a time. We live in a world that is very much intermingled. As you indicated, the problems in Israel and Palestine bubble over into that whole region, and they bubble all around the world. And we've got to deal with those issues as well as the issues right here at home. And it's a couple of
them. I wanted to ask you, I'm sure familiar with the old philosophers.
religious freedom and international influence way beyond just and I don't know if there's any sufficient critical mass of thinking in that area that we could allow for that.
Well, you may have two questions. One, you asked about Elias Shakur, the author of Blood Brothers, who's written several books. And he has recently been elevated to be an archbishop. And the church is new Catholic. It's not Roman Catholic. No, but his area will be Christians in Israel proper, not in Palestine. Although he is very much interested in and he has done a marvelous job with a wonderful organizer. He's built schools and done a lot of very creative things. Then you ask the question of Jerusalem. And that is one that has been very dear to my heart. Not only did we fall in love with the city and we love the people and the sites, but if Holy Land is the key to the Holy Beliefs, I think it's just Jerusalem is the key to the Holy Land. And it's one of those problems that we listed in the roadmap that President Bush and the so-called Quartet established as one of the issues to be settled after everything has been resolved. And I am convinced, and if the future is convinced, that this is got to be resolved sooner rather than later, and that it is urgent at the moment because of the way in which the wall is being developed and in which the movement is being isolated from the rest of Palestine. Jerusalem is a city that is considered holy, maybe the holiest place by Jews. The Western Wall is a specific place of devotion. The Christians, where the faith began, and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, stands over the place where Jesus was crucified, and where the tomb was, and where he rose from the dead. So it's crucial to us. And Muslims are very, very devoted to the area on the platform around the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Golden Rock. That is the third most holy place in the world for Muslims. So Jerusalem has a very unique situation in the world. And this may sound spooky to some of you who haven't been there. But you go to Jerusalem and you feel that it is a sacred place. Not just because of the people who live there, or the buildings, old buildings, but there is something about that place that draws out the spiritual side of all of humanity. And one of the things that future is planning right now, and I'm working on, is a plan to bring together the religious leaders of all of them, Jews, Muslims, Christians, and religious leaders from this country, Jews, Christians, Muslims, along with some of the principal religious leaders from the rest of the world. Probably going to hold this in the Washington, D.C. area. And it will probably be early next fall. And deal with the issue of Jerusalem. And But one of the things that I find very helpful is the Jewish rabbis that we are working with, and the Muslim leaders that we are working with, and the Christian leaders from the United States that we are working with, and I know the ones in Palestine as well, really want this to be done. One of the hopeful signs that I see is that the U.S. government has resisted a lot of pressure to formally put the U.S. into this opportunity. We're going to see this going out of the we've got property that was bought back in the rain. And those who would like to sell the State Department begin building that embassy right now for the currency shipping. And wisely, that's been resisted. One of the issues involved is that the property is a disputed property. It is part of the property that was overrun by the police in one of the wars. The deeds are officially in the Palestinian. And so it's no place for the United States to just start building the building. But I think it would be marvelous and very powerful if it could be an embassy to sort of both our relationship with Israel and the Palestinian. And if somehow Israel could be the capital of Palestine, part of Jerusalem could be the capital of Israel and the capital. No place else in the world has ever done that. But we need to think outside the box. And this is a city that I look at that in the world. At that time, it was
a lot. I have a question that going back to Hamas. It seems like Hamas, I never read about the special force tactics of Hamas until it was left. So I feel like, you know, in our press, we knew nothing about that whole side of it. But all we heard about was the terrorists. So it was the same leadership that is doing both of these, you know.
Well, there is a Muslim that is put in charge of the military power of Hamas.
So when they elected Hamas, which they elected both? Was that it?
Well, they probably. I mean, there are some people that the Palestinians live in Gaza. You know, Gaza is the most densely populated part. And at the present time, we can't begin to conclude the words are so tight and clear, but it is new. Something is related to that. Gaza can't leave. And it is a desperate situation. That's the center. There are not many Hamas in other parts of the U.S. science program. Some, but not nearly as many as in Gaza. And in Gaza, I suspect when the voting was done, it was voting not only for the humanitarian point of Hamas, but also for the fight. But mainly in the West Bank, that is to say, in part of from Palestine is on the front of the Jordan. Mainly there, the vote for Hamas is the vote against Mr. Arafat. They lost confidence in their decision.
Internationally, that all the press is going to have terrorists. So in the short term,
it is a very great problem. Yeah. But I think we have to say there are great problems, and the way what we need to do is
finally educate ourselves to what we see here, but also try to deal with national and universal.
Martin, I'm going to comment on the Israeli.
Great question. Let's comment on the Israeli. I first got to know Peter Holmer when he was the successor to Terry Powell, who chucked the first of the sermon as the mayor of Jerusalem. He came into that role. Some people would say he stole the election, the way in which he organized it. But he did a relatively good job and befriended the Christians and Muslims in ways that some others have not. So I won't discount I believe that the vote there was he didn't win by very didn't get as much of a mandate as they had hoped. And the parties will have to be a coalition in Israel. And the fact is that Israel is terribly flawed. That's why they're all in this fashion. And the religious parties have very strong leaders. And there are too many of them. And because there are so many of them, they're weaker. So many parties, not people, a lot of religious people, but the religious parties that exist primarily to look out for some of the religious activities in Israel, and to make sure that anybody who wants to defend his or her life studies the Torah. Hey, do that. I mean, there are schools that exist for these people simply to study Torah. Now, I'm not as a former seminary. I'm not knocking that. But they do it full time for all their lives. And these parties insist that the government pay for that. And people get paid to study. And that's a relatively small number, but those parties are small. There are also parties that support the second movement, and they have been pretty much isolated now. And Labor, which is made up of the old line people, who most of whom are socialists, have come back a little bit, but they are the number two party. And then there are some liberal and other parties in our list. It is so fractured that it's going to be very difficult for there to be a strong government. And it's always going to have to work very hard to cobble together a coalition.
They recently had an Arab conference and they had their coalition. And just thinking, you know, these are countries that are in the region, they have huge stake in what we're going to do because we have many conflicts and economically and all. And why can't they get it together? And they should be coming up with some solutions and taking the problem. Shouldn't they? I mean, I just feel like they are.
Well, you're right. And certainly, as we look at it from our perspective, your assessment is that. The fact is that in those countries, take Egypt, for example, the government of Egypt is scared to death of the emerging Islamist group in Egypt that would like to take control. And so they don't want to get too deeply involved because this Islamist group worked out the current leadership there. Jordan, was not represented there by a king. He was the foreign minister of the land. And he was trying to send a message that
they won't go too far without the unified. If we went to the region, we would have to commit itself right on the spot. So it's, they're kind of waiting and seeing. And I think, in part, it's because they want to see what Hamas does. They want to see how the United States and Europe, the European Union, and Russia respond to Hamas. They want to see what the United States is going to eventually do in Iraq. And they don't get along too well with each other. Partly it's that the legacy of the fact that those countries all got carved up by the colonial power in particular. And they don't even have a very coherent situation anymore. So it's very complicated.
Anyway, Northside Jewish Catholic, about 15 years ago, I asked one of our bishops, Joseph Ritter, who was in the 70s. I said, why have the Palestinians resorted to terror? That's what I say, that we've got to learn to turn the other cheek. You know. And his answer really came. He says, what do you expect of the people who, decade after decade, have had their faces pushed into the dirt? And it's just such a bad moment. But I have another question. I can't see them in the verse in the book. Dear Mom.
You have a mission Saudi Arabia. Did you get some people from that group to use the direct
company? The quick answer is no. We have not, if you're asking about the different future and the organization, the answer is no. But there are Muslims who look to Saudi Arabia as their holy place, but the government there has not ordered to the Muslim organization there.
Christians have now made up maybe 3% of that area. And the question is, why have they chosen to leave and not become suicide bombers? Or as another part of the movement, you know, taking their
lead? Well, he's saying, why hasn't there been too much emigration from that area to the United States and elsewhere among Christians? Well, many of them have stayed and are staying and are dedicated to trying to find a resolution to the problem, but not by fighting.
Because they're Christians?
Essentially because they're Christians. But many Muslims have also immigrated. The difference between a friend of mine who's a sociologist at Bethlehem University, and he studied this, and he has discovered that Christians have left primarily because of their earlier contacts in the West. First of all, their contacts with missionaries and other Christians. And then later, because they have family in the West. And they leave for economic reasons, primarily to send their kids to university and then to establish themselves in business here. Many Muslims have done the same, but not to the same extent, because they have not had the contacts in the West until now. But I think that's going to grow dramatically. The one exception to that is that in Lebanon, there are almost an equal number of Christian and Muslim immigrants to work. And that's why you have these very large Lebanese communities in the United States and in the country.
And there is pretty much a lesson.
And it's getting back there. Our daughter is in the community.
It's very encouraging that we set up the academy in the very leadership of the different groups. But in my observation, there's plenty of bad groups out there that can turn followers against the leaders so quickly. And get close to getting the revolution to 100% for one side. And I'm wondering, what is it that we can do? What is happening with our organization or other organizations where just ordinary folks can start with building the bridges to support the leadership staying the course and not and helping us support the leaders?
Thank you for that question. Different Future is a relatively new organization. And one of the things that we are looking at is the viability of having chapters or encouraging local organizations. We had an experiment last fall with last spring, you know, we call last spring with a international teleconference. All of this, it was all done through computers. And it was done with speakers and screens and all of that, but done for all the schools. It could be done with computers. You didn't have all the fancy Marvel stuff. I guess I'm in the Marvel territory there, but for sure. But we did this and established 35 communities across the United States where people could come together. And that took a lot of work to organize all of that and get people to get together and we wanted each one of those to be recognized or appreciated. Because we think that our organization is unique in that it brings those people together. And we're committed to continuing to do that.
Probably just have time for one more question, and then I'll let Linda have the last one. Martin, I do hope that it's possible we can get you back sometime in the fall or early winter, and we can take this up to chat with you.
I'm
going to
what we do
for
the there's so much verbiage, and there has been for so many years. Quite honestly, I don't see the forest for two things. And if you were to ask me what's going on right now, I don't know that I can answer that. I'd be trying to keep up with you. Do you have any suggestions for some way to cut to the chase and really?
That's a great question. And I'm going to just hint at it because it's a very broad question. In the first place, we live in an area where the press is not being as good as the claims. As a matter of fact, I believe that the summer leaders have a better job than the New York Times on the releases. But I've been following it very closely, and it's because there have been two or three editors at the summer leaders who have really worked on it, and because they recognize that their decision. Now, that's one part of the answer. The other is that although you can easily get swarmed, you can get an awful lot on the internet. You can go and read op-eds, the liberal publications, the television, and you get a much broader span of information than you get there.
Say that name one more time?
Hopper-Ells.
But there are also groups on the internet that can feed you more information than you have time to read. I mean, that's not the way you can get overwhelmed by it. But
but it's there in a way that it wasn't there before. And one of the things that another organization that has been working on is trying to help the newspapers and television networks here realize that they think they've got to do that.
Mark, thank you very much. He's available for